So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
Hello, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardawar.
I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, we're going to be focusing on social media as the place where civil society is happening right now. Everything is tech. A lot of us are trapped at home. I'm sure many of you are watching the protests and everything happening in this country. So we want to talk about the impact of social media and specifically how Twitter and Facebook are handling their responsibilities right now as the major channels of society. Things are pretty rough in America these days. Since last week, there have been nightly protests against police violence and specifically how cops value Black lives. This was all sparked off by George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis, but that's not the only story. Obviously, there was Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, who was gunned down by citizens. There was Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, who was killed by cops in her own apartment. There's not much for us to say about all this as a tech podcast, but I do want to express support for everybody in the streets fighting for a more just world. They've also been joined by massive protests worldwide, which I think is the single most heartening thing to see right now. So I just wanted to say I support you all, especially if you're out there on the streets. If you can't be there in person, there's a lot you can do. You can donate to bail funds. You can promote Black and Brown voices on your own channels. Help fight against racism in your own communities. There are so many other ways we could be doing this. Whatever you do, stay safe. Sherlyn, did you want to say anything here?
I think your point about tech being where life is happening right now is even more true because social media and tech are just our window into the world, as we're all mostly stuck at home. And it's always been sort of a window into another world. But right now, it's like our only way to view the world. Like, there's media, but there's social media, which is even more, I think, relentless. So it definitely is within our wheelhouse. And for those people who don't want to go out and protest, I get it. I have my own safety issues to consider, too.
It's hard to protest in the middle of a global pandemic.
Exactly.
Like, there's so, oh, man, it's all this stuff is hitting us all at once. So,
and I think for people, like you said, donate. I've done that. But I think another thing we can all do is listen. And listen to people and what they're saying. So there you go.
I will say one writer who I really enjoy reading everything he writes is Charlie Warzel over at the New York Times op-ed section. And he wrote a great piece about basically this is the thing. This is the one thing we're all watching every night. We must bear witness is the way he put it. And we're seeing so many videos of police violence. We're seeing videos of the protests. We're seeing real-time communications, you know, live streams. We're seeing all this stuff all at once.
Yep.
It's hard to ignore it. Like, maybe we could in previous protests. And there have been many protests over the last few years. But it feels like we're at a point, too, where everybody can stream easily. Everybody can share easily. And also, maybe it has something to do, too, because of the fact that so many of us are at home. Mm-hmm. We're already used to being on social media every night. And now it's the thing. It's flooding all of our channels. It's not just one or two activist friends who are sharing these things. It's everywhere. You can't avoid it. But I think that's an important thing. As always, be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Drop us a review. Anything is appreciated. And we also have a new form for handling questions. You find that whenever we post these episodes, or it's right there. But you can also email us at podcast@engadget.com. There's so many ways to get in touch. Please send us your questions, your advice, and your comments about everything happening right now. So it's been a particularly crazy week for Twitter and Facebook. Mm-hmm. And it's honestly hard to fathom how much has happened since last Tuesday. So joining us today is Carissa Bell, senior editor in Engadget, focusing on social media. Carissa, how's it going?
Going well. Thanks for having me.
You have had a very busy week. Like, I just remember when all these things started
First
happening.
First of all, Carissa always is busy, right? Like, the social media beat is, like, not my, I do not envy your job. Like, but this week has been extra, extra chaotic.
Yeah. Can we start from the beginning? Because I believe there was on May 26th, there was an internal report from Facebook about how they were handling political division. And basically, the company was very aware that its platform was divisive and in general would promote the most like extreme views. But there was really a reticence to do much about that. Can you tell us what was going on there?
Yeah. And, you know, it's crazy that you said this was on May 26th because it kind of, to me, feels like it was 2 months ago already. But yeah, so the Wall Street Journal published this really big story about Facebook after the 2016 election. They had sort of undertaken this effort to kind of look at whether, you know, does Facebook actually make things more divisive? Does it create polarization? You know, a lot of questions that were on people's minds, you know, after Trump was elected. And what the researchers found was that actually, yes, it does. In a lot of ways, their own algorithms feed into this divisiveness in a lot of cases. One example was in Facebook groups that that if you join groups and they actually will recommend groups that promote extremist content. And so this was something that, you know, Facebook's researchers who are working on this, I guess, were pretty worried about. According to the Wall Street Journal, you know, the stuff was eventually, some of it was brought to Zuckerberg and, you know, really kind of not a lot necessarily happened. I think some changes were maybe implemented. A lot of others were rejected. And then it kind of says that Zuckerberg basically just sort of lost interest in this idea. And he's since kind of like walked back from, you know, talking about whether this idea of whether or not Facebook is divisive. He's kind of decided that it's not and has indicated he kind of wants to spend his time on other problems, let's say.
Despite their own research, I feel like this whole situation really, this is kind of the heart of everything, too, that also happened over the last week. Like, the way Mark Zuckerberg thinks about, I think, the value of the conversations on his platform and the way he weights certain things. I would say, like, looking at Facebook anecdotally, I think we could all see, like, the platform would send you to more extreme things because, listen, that's what Facebook wants, right? They want you to engage, and sending you to the craziest spots, talking to the craziest groups is probably the best way to do that. It is a shame that, yeah, they just did not think too much about the moral obligation of that. So what also happened on May 26th, Carissa?
So on that same day, Twitter took a new step it's never done before, and that it added a small fact check to two of Trump's tweets. And these were the tweets that, I know there's been many tweets since then. These are the tweets that were talking about voter fraud with regards to mail-in ballots that said, you know, they're substantially fraudulent, that basically in California.
Mailboxes will be robbed, ballots will be forged, fire will fall from the sky.
Everybody can get a mail-in ballot no matter who you are, how you got to this country, et cetera, et cetera. So Twitter did something they've never done before. They added a small fact check that said, get the facts about mail-in voting, or mail-in ballots, rather, and then it linked to a Twitter moment that had some debunks from news organizations and had a few bullet points, you know, saying that it was, you know, what he said was incorrect, and had a few basic facts about how mail-in ballots actually work.
Did that feel like a triumph? That kind of felt like it was Twitter's tongue-in-cheek way of going. Not even tongue-in-cheek. It was kind of just a way around, like, still keeping him on, but kind of checking what he says in tandem.
I mean, I think some people, like, their first reaction was to see it as a kind of triumph, especially because Facebook has refused to do any kind of fact-checking on his words. And Twitter doesn't necessarily do a lot of fact-checking in the same way that Facebook does. So I think a lot of people kind of saw this as like some big statement or something. But I think once you actually kind of dig into what they said, it wasn't really as big of a deal as maybe it seemed like it was at the time, you know? Like, the actual label didn't say this is wrong. Like, you could have read it to say that, you know, oh, I'm going to get more information about this voter fraud, you know?
Like, backing up what he said. Right.
Yeah. I think, was it Nicole Lee at Engadget wrote about how, like, this was just kind of a toothless move by Twitter. But even because of
it's
that.
It's better than nothing,
it's,
I guess.
Well, it's better than nothing. But also, like, even though it was just such a, like, a slap on the wrist. Like, it was a nothing admonition against Trump. He did not take this too well.
Of course not.
And, you know, I think on another level, it was maybe a little bit symbolic because they've also kind of given Trump and, you know, many other politicians as well, frankly, like, a lot of latitude in terms of what they say. Mm-hmm. So I think even, you know, adding that small label, it was, you know, sort of a symbolic step for them that, like, you know, they are willing to go there, and especially with regards to, you know, interfering with, you know, people's information about voting, which Twitter and Facebook are supposed to have policies, strict policies about.
Yeah.
And what was funny too is, like, even after that happened, what Zuckerberg had a Fox interview where he disagreed with the post warning. That was May 28th. That was just 2 days later. Which, first of all, great place to go to talk about how much you care about, facts and everything, Zuck. But then I feel like Trump was the example of the "you mad bro" meme, because he signed an executive order that would potentially limit protections for social media companies. A most likely ineffective thing. Like, it's kind of a useless slap on the wrist against everybody. But man, what was up with that, Carissa?
Yeah, he has talked about this in the past. You know, this isn't the first time that Trump has said that he wants to, like, rail in these social media companies. And, you know, there's been this kind of thought from him and others in his party that, you know, they're biased against him somehow, and, you know, they're going to take some sort of action. So this executive order, from the reporting, it sounds like, was actually something, you know, they had kind of had floating around for at least a year. It wasn't necessarily new, I guess. But so he sent this executive order that basically it's trying to walk back some of the protections that these social media companies get under what's known as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is a 1996 law that's really foundational for the internet. Basically says that internet companies cannot be liable for the content that their users post. And so this executive order would basically kind of ask the FCC, FTC, to see if they can try and put some limits on that protection. A lot of experts say it's not really going to be enforceable, but, you know, that was kind of his big sort of...
Yeah. It's basically like a memo to a committee to suggest something that likely will never happen, right?
Yes. Congress actually oversees these agencies, not the executive branch, for one. a lot of lawyers say, and experts on, you know, communications law in Section 230 say that's not really going to be enforceable. It's almost definitely going to get challenged in court. So, I mean, it seems fairly toothless on its face. Same time, it could still be a big headache for these companies, you know, if they have to go to court and litigate this, especially smaller companies that, you know, might not have the resources of a Facebook or a Google.
Ironically enough, Trump is one of, I think, the most, you know, important people who benefits from Section 230, right? Like, the way he treats Twitter and Facebook and other platforms, like, his ability to say so much of what he wants is protected by the thing he's trying to abolish. Man, gotta love it. Gotta love this guy.
Yeah, it's a bit of an own goal, really.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that analogy.
He's so mad. The next day, Jesus, I think, was the thing that really kicked off, because the Black Lives Matter protests started the previous day, and Trump sent out a tweet that was basically instigating violence against the protesters. What happened there, Carissa?
Yeah, so there was a late night tweet from Trump, as there often is. Basically, it was appeared to threaten the protesters, and it said, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts," which was a reference, a pretty troubling reference from the 1960s, has sort of a history of being associated with violence, especially racial violence. So at that point, that was up for a few hours before Twitter then actually took this step that they hid the tweet behind this sort of interstitial kind of notice that said this tweet violates our policy against glorification of violence, but, you know, we're leaving this up because it's newsworthy. So essentially what they're saying was, you know, this would break our rules, we would take it down, except it's from Trump, so we're leaving it up, but, you know, we disagree with this. And that basically, you know, set off an explosion of just craziness. And, you know, if you thought that the little tiny fact check was a big deal, this definitely was taking things a step further.
What do you guys think of this step, right? Like, it's not as toothless, but it's not, I don't know what you guys think, basically, right? I have my own thoughts. I think it's a better move.
I think this is the best way they could have done it, right? Because the the notification around election, election
mail-in
fraud.
Yeah.
It wasn't even like a bold warning color. It was just like a blue exclamation mark. It just felt, it didn't feel as like a big warning. Whereas this is like, hey, it's like when you go to like, if you're going to certain websites and like things are kind of dangerous or violent or gross behind it. If anybody who used to visit Rotten.com back in the day, it's just like really, really gross things you see on the internet. This had that sort of veil of like, oh man, there's something really bad behind here.
Yeah.
And that may not mean much for Trump supporters, but I think it does. It says something about Twitter and how it manages the content on its own service. And that's also something our friend Mark Zuckerberg did not choose to do, because that same, first of all, Twitter blocked that on the Trump account, and then they added it to the official White House account, where the same block also happened, which is I'm sure like some genius there thought like, oh, I got another account, you know, like when a troll gets blocked, they go to one of their other accounts. It just happens to be the official White House account. What a world we live in. Mark Zuckerberg, our friend, chose not to do any of that blocking on Facebook. And he gave a very long explanation. There was a lot going on here. Any major takeaways from that, Carissa, on your end?
Yeah. And, you know, the weird thing is, so, you know, that same tweet was cross-posted on Facebook, as Trump does.
Yeah.
And pretty much almost entire day went by before we heard anything from Facebook about it. You know, a lot of us were asking, you know, as soon as we saw it, you know, because Facebook also has rules against glorifying violence. You know, the rules are not that different from Twitter's in that regard.
Yeah. And they have blocked posts and removed things from some like really, really bad politicians in the past, but just not Trump and not Republicans typically.
Yes. They did remove one ad of his once about the census. Okay. But yeah, so we didn't hear anything for a very long time. And then Zuckerberg comes out with this long post and he basically says, you know, I know a lot of people are upset about this. And he said that he was personally, you know, upset by it. And he thought it was, you know, ugly rhetoric and it was divisive and all that. But he basically, you know, said what he's been saying. He thinks that Facebook needs to enable as much speech as possible. He said we looked very closely at that post and, you know, discussed whether it violated our policies against glorification of violence. And, you know, ultimately said that they didn't think it did. He said, although the post had a troubling historical reference, we decided to leave it up because the National Guard references meant we read it as a warning about state action, and we think people need to know if the government is planning to deploy force. Our policy around incitement of violence allows discussion around state use of force, although I think today's situation raises important questions about what potential limits of that discussion should be. So he kind of did that thing that he does where he, you know, says, well, this doesn't break our rules. If it had broken our rules, we would have taken it down. You know, so he says that there is some hypothetical line Trump could cross, but this wasn't it. And then he also sort of criticized Twitter, saying that, you know, if Facebook thought it was wrong, then they would have not labeled it. They would have taken it down. So,
and they're doing less than what Twitter has done. And they're like, no, Twitter hasn't done enough if they really thought it was a violation. Meanwhile, we don't think it is a violation. Man, this you know, you said that hypothetical limit thing just now, and that's totally true, right? And what Zuck's also doing is like what I think a lot of people are doing, which is like, you know, it doesn't really move the needle right now, but you know, it forces us to think about what the potential limits should be. And I'm just like, this is such an empty answer. Like, going to think about it. We're going to think about it as a way to delay and try to distract everyone until they can forget about you. And so you can pretend like it never happened, I think.
I mean, we've seen Facebook do this time and time again where they get flack for this and then they'll say, you know, well, we're rethinking our policies. We might change this at some point, you know, and they kind of make these noises because they sort of want credit for saying that they, you know, they're thinking about changing without actually making a change or actually doing anything.
So after Zuckerberg, you know, announced his post, there was a tense call with employees. Recode had a transcription of that. And what really struck me about that whole conversation is that so many words, it's really all just so many words of like Zuckerberg excusing himself for not doing anything. And it's shocking to me, like how much of this, like these major decisions, he's the CEO, he's the guy in charge. But so much of it just comes down to him in his judgment what he thinks. And that's kind of ridiculous.
I was thinking at the start, yeah. right? When we were just delving into this, where Zuck said, like, you know, they presented the research findings uh-huh. to Zuck and he just got disinterested. I was like, okay, this guy has too much power. And wasn't there an oversight board, Carissa? Like, didn't they just make a big deal about their oversight board mm-hmm, committee?
Mm-hmm. They did. And the oversight board sort of weighed in on this, actually. And they said, well, mm-hmm. They commented on the situation, I should say. And that, you know, they're just really not set up yet. They're like, we were just announced. Mm-hmm. Facebook said these people don't even have their laptops yet. They said that this is the kind of post that they would potentially weigh in right. on once they're set up, but they're not yeah. set up yet. And it's, you know, going to be some time before they're really have everything in place to start kind of making these decisions. And by the way, even once they are able to start, you know, officially
yeah.
weighing in, it's not going to be a quick process. You know, we're talking like 30 to 90 days or something like that. So I'm not exactly sure how helpful they even would be in this situation.
It's funny. Facebook was the company of move fast and break things. But when it comes to actually fixing its platform, it's move slow and think things, basically. Like it's very much the opposite of solving all of its problems. I think what's also really interesting, too, is that this points to like the major problem of just having a single person making these judgments, yeah. too, right? Because it's like Zuckerberg does not have maybe the fullest life experience, you know. This is a guy who founded this company when he was very young. He mm-hmm. got very, you know, this thing grew so quickly, and I think time and time again he's proven that he's just not equipped to make like larger moral decisions. So yeah, when he reads it's like, oh, the Trump tweet, he's like, oh yeah, it's just the National Guard. He's just talking about bringing the National Guard somewhere, whereas somebody with maybe a little more historical perspective, somebody who maybe also could be hurt, somebody actually black or brown who could be hurt by this police violence, would read that and be like, he's threatening to kill me. This is not like a right. you know, a hypothetical. This is a very direct thing of what's happening. But Zuck doesn't see it that way. So Facebook doesn't see it that way. So it stays up and billions of people get to read it.
And yeah. so that's the thing, right? If he doesn't see it as that way, the company therefore has to like,
yeah.
that's their stance. And that's a problem because I know a lot of people, like some close friends of mine actually work at Facebook. And, you know, at first when the whole pandemic started, they were very grateful because the company was giving every single employee money to tide them through the lockdown. So every single Facebook employee, I mm-hmm. think, got $1,000 to use however the hell they wanted. Similar to the way like Google gave a lot of their employees $1,000 stipend to set up work from home things now. But, you know, and that like made a lot of the friends that I know who work for Facebook, they were very grateful. And they were very much like, oh, you know, my boss really cares for me. And then meanwhile, this happened and now all their employees are pissed off, as far as I can tell. Right. Yep. Like there were walkouts this week.
Well, flash forward to June 1st. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So beginning of this week, Facebook employees staged a virtual walkout where they just signed out of company services. It was the best they could do of walking out mm-hmm. during a pandemic. Seems like the most vocal disruption we've ever seen from Facebook employees on my end.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's a little, you know, with a virtual walkout and everyone being at home, I think it's a little bit hard to judge exactly sort of how widespread this is, but essentially, you know, employees didn't come to work. They, in their out of office messages, they said, you know, that they were doing this as a show to support the protesters. And then what we saw, which we don't normally see, is we saw many, many Facebook employees publicly speaking out against the company,
yeah.
you know, saying they don't agree with the decision, you know, that they're very upset by it, making, you know, these statements on social media, which, you know, is sort of something that is pretty rare for, you know, yeah. Facebook employees, especially many Facebook employees and some fairly senior folks, you know, saying that I disagree with Mark on this and I want to change his mind. And, you know, I'm not proud of this and I want to do something to change the situation within Facebook.
Do we think that this will change Mark's mind? Do we think?
You know, it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
I think on one hand, he seems like he's sort of dug in on his position and mm-hmm. has said that, you know, he thinks he's right on this. He doesn't want to be arbiter of truth. Yeah. He thinks Facebook should be on the side of more speech. You know, he talks about how he has concerns right. that once you chip away at speech, it's very hard to get it back. And, you know, he makes many philosophical arguments about this. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he is going to change his mm-hmm. his opinion, how he feels about this. At the same time, he is sort of making some noises again that, you know, Facebook might change something at some point. You know, Facebook is known to, you know, respond to PR backlash that's ongoing. Yeah. So, you know, I think there is a chance we could see them sort of tweak some of their rules or, you know, do something differently. But I don't think Zuckerberg, you know, at his core is actually going to change how he thinks about this stuff. I think
I will say this is not like this attitude is not entirely new, right? Since last year, they decided not to fact check politician posts. So like there's always been like a little special leeway for people like Trump and other politicians. But what was interesting on June 2nd is that something we definitely don't see too often is Facebook employees were vocally resigning. Yeah. There was one employee who posted, you know, why he was leaving, I believe an engineer on LinkedIn that went viral. A few other people followed, not like major people, but the fact that people are out there talking about this experience and saying like how much they just had to get away from Facebook and what they were doing. I think that that really says quite a lot, right?
It does. And then there was also, I don't know if you guys saw it, there was an open letter that was published in the New York Times just the other day from a group of former employees who, you know, some of these were pretty influential people there at Facebook in the early days. There was the first head of PR. There was the one of the first employees to ever kind of write their community standards. So somebody who was very intimately familiar with Facebook's rules, how they work, how the company has historically enforced these things. And they basically said, you know, this isn't the Facebook we know. Like, it really pains us to come out here and criticize the company, but, you know, we really disagree with what they're doing. And the Facebook we know is all about giving users more free speech and giving users you know, a voice. And when you moderate and fact check users and you don't do that to politicians, you know, you're doing the opposite.
I mean, that would, I mean, man, like, what a heavy topic, right? Like, it's a lot to process. It's a lot to think about. But I mean,
while all this was happening, right, Facebook and Twitter were still being used
by people
amid
to
the protests. Such an important platform, right?
They are. And I think that, again, we made this point earlier, but like social media being our only window really into what's going on right now has such a great impact. So with the protests taking place in real life on the streets, they also took to social media. And obviously there was, you know, hashtag Black Lives Matter. And then on Tuesday, there was Blackout Tuesday, which, by the way, like has somewhat questionable
there's a whole story
that takes a bit of explaining, and I don't know like how much you want to get into that, but after Black Lives Matter started trending, then like, you know, other things started trending as well, like hashtag Blue Lives Matter, hashtag White Lives Matter. And I think the funny thing that came out of it was it showed how easy it was to hijack these hashtag movements, where now if you go look at hashtag White Lives Matter, you'll see a lot of K-pop GIFs, which is great. And I say GIFs, don't even come at me.
Oh, my God.
but yeah, you'll see a lot of K-pop stans trying to drown out the hashtag, which is what kind of people were afraid would happen with Blackout Tuesday. But people found ways around that. It goes to show that like these platforms are huge, and these platforms have a huge way of affecting the discourse around these issues. I mean, Carissa, you cover these. I mean, these are probably the two biggest, right? Like, I can't think of what else.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very powerful, and you know, like you kind of said, I think a lot of people came down on a lot of different sides on how they feel about how, you know, exactly how these hashtags were being used or were not being used. You know, but I think at the end of the day, it was like a pretty powerful show just in terms of, you know, seeing just how many people, you know, were taking part in these conversations. And then, you know, just to go back to the K-pop thing, my favorite meme that I saw was apparently they were trying to get, you know, white out to trend, and then there the K-pop stans were sharing images of like white out like the correction fluid. And I just thought that was so funny. And
I think around the time
fans
it's hilarious. And then around the time White Lives Matter was trending, Twitter categorized it under K-pop, right? Like, you have the trending column on the right, White Lives Matter, and then the little label saying Y is K-pop. And that was just quite funny. But so big social media networks like Twitter and Facebook, I think, seem to be more careful about how they react. But this week also, a smaller company, I guess, like Snap, did announce that it would no longer be promoting Trump's account in their like content curation area. Do you think this is a more significant move, Carissa, than what Twitter and Facebook have been doing?
So I actually do in some ways. I don't know if I would say it's more significant. But, you know, you say smaller. Snapchat has more daily users than Twitter does.
That's true, yeah.
They have a lot of users. They have a lot of young people. Snapchat's actually an extremely important platform for Donald Trump's campaign. They spend a ton of money there. They have a huge presence. You know, their channel is not insignificant. They sell a lot of merchandise. They have a team that makes a lot of content for it. So what Snapchat essentially announced was they are not blocking any of his posts or removing his content or anything like that, but they're taking his channel out of that For You section of Discover, which is kind of like that main Discover section, you know, that's algorithmically sorted, where you see all the publishers and channels. So they're taking him out of that entirely. So from now on, the only way people will find Trump's content on Snapchat is if they're subscribed to him already or if they actually search Donald Trump. But he will not appear. Okay. He will not get any more free promotion, they called it, by them.
I think that's fair. And then obviously Trump, I'm pretty sure.
Got mad again.
He got mad, even though I don't think he's on Snap. But as in like personally, I don't think he understands.
Right, right.
Or is on Snap.
But he knows where his image is.
Yeah.
There was a statement from his campaign manager, you know, about how this was, you know, really unfair. And I think he called it like.
Can we just read this statement from Brad Parscale? Because I feel like it reads like an angry high school note, like when somebody is mean to you at high school. Here is the statement from Donald Trump's campaign manager. Snapchat is trying to rig the 2020 election, illegally using their corporate funding to promote Joe Biden and suppress President Trump. Radical Snapchat CEO Evan Spiegel would rather promote extreme left-right videos and encourage their users to destroy America than share the positive words of unity, justice, and law and order from our president. Snapchat hates that so many of their users watch the president's content, and so they are actively engaging in voter suppression. If you're a conservative, they do not want to hear from you. They do not want you to vote. They view you as a deplorable, and they do not want you to exist on their platform. This is insane.
It incites rage.
This is an insane statement.
Wow.
Yeah, it's unhinged.
That's a lot. I mean, you put it really well when we first reacted to this statement, Dev. You said something like, this is a high school kid's, a playground statement, right? Like, I don't want to be friends with you either.
Yeah. It's really just a step away from 1v1 me IRL. Fight me, bro.
Come at me, bro. Yeah.
It also seems like kind of a misreading of Snapchat's audience, you know? Like, this is sort of a statement that would play well on Fox News, but I don't know if, like, Snapchat kids really, you know, care about radical Evan Spiegel.
Every line of this thing. Yeah.
So speaking of the Snapchat kids, Carissa, do you think that Donald Trump and his campaign have a presence on TikTok?
Oh.
And do you think TikTok will eventually have some kind of reaction to all of this? Because I feel like TikTok is the up and coming and it's pretty huge.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if they have an official account, but, you know, as we get deeper into the election, though, I would absolutely expect that the campaigns would try to do something there. I don't know how successful that will be or...
I would say the one good thing I will say about the Donald Trump campaign is that they have been very good at leveraging social media and online tools and certainly in better ways than a lot of Democrats have. So you can bet he will be on TikTok sending those I want to see him jump in on the TikTok memes. Like that's just what I want to see before this all blows over.
That's what I think he's good for is like TikTok challenges.
Okay, so that was quite a journey, Carissa, and I expect things aren't going to be slowing down. The protests are still happening, and social media is like as important as ever. I don't know about you guys, but I am on every single night just looking at the videos, looking at the posts from everybody, sharing what I can. Do you have any major takeaways, Carissa and Sherlyn? Like, do you guys have any major takeaways from everything that's been happening? Just from this one week, which feels like a month, which... you could have told me happened last year and I would easily believe you.
Carissa, go ahead.
I mean, we're at a moment where you know, we're seeing so many historically significant events kind of converge at one time. Mm-hmm. You know, there's these huge peaceful protests movement that's happening. Of course, we're in a pandemic. We see social media companies, you know, trying to actually sort of take a stand in terms of what their platforms can be used for. So,
I did hear that monkeys escaped with the coronavirus, which is a real thing. So now there are loose monkeys with coronavirus out somewhere in the UK. So yeah, everything is happening all at once. Yeah.
So, you know, for me, it does feel like, you know, we are kind of at an important moment where, you know, these companies are kind of, they've tried to avoid for all of Trump's presidency, you know, to have to kind of make these choices and weigh in on this because, you know, that's not really a position they want to be in at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think we're seeing like the urgency of our times, you know, of a pandemic, of, you know, this kind of really ugly, troubling, you know, rhetoric, you know, violence against peaceful protesters, I think is sort of putting them in a position where they can't really defend that anymore, or it's becoming a lot harder to. And all of a sudden these decisions that, you know, they've been trying to avoid making, you know, are suddenly all happening at once. So, you know, it does feel like, you know, we are kind of at a big turning point.
Which I think ultimately is the takeaway and the good news out of this is that something's got to give. And for me, mm-hmm. even like I see the point in that, like I even have had to think about where I want to like, whether I want to say something so-called publicly on my social media about things like that, because like I'm generally the sort of person that shies away from making too much of a statement because I'm worried about my like my status here. And this week has just been so hard, and it's been like I'm not like you, Devendra, like I mm-hmm. you're able to like look at it nightly to be updated. I can't, because when I look at it, it overwhelms me. I feel very like I've cried so many times in the past week because of everything, right? Because mm-hmm. I feel mm-hmm. pressure as to like I need to know what I want to say, how like I know how I feel, but do I mm-hmm. need to say about how I feel? And I think in the same way these companies are making similar decisions, like in a much grander and more important scale, of course. Right. But like I, you know, social media being like at the core of this, and given the times we're in now, like everyone's been locked down, so everyone's attention cannot be distracted. Everyone's focused on what's going on right now. All over the world, we're watching. And so there's more pressure than ever before to consider this. And I think that that's what we kind of needed, because this has been years and years and years that it's been a problem. It's been decades. Mm-hmm. It's been so, so long a problem. And finally, that there is some traction behind this, I think, you know, it's become time for companies to actually do something. Like, I finally decided to say something, and I think that companies need to. It's never, like, just do it.
For sure. And this is something I've mentioned before. Is like, these companies, all tech companies, like, were built on the idea of getting as big as possible, of gaining as many users, of gaining their influence. And these companies, they did it. They mm-hmm. they made it happen. And now I think they really need to reflect on the responsibility of what they have, you know, of what they've built as platforms. Like, this is where everything is happening. You can't just be neutral. I think you need a little more historical perspective to really judge what's happening on your own platform. So, Carissa, thank you so much for joining us. We hope to chat with you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So with all the protests that are going on, it happens to be very timely that this week Google actually rolled out new personal safety features to all the Pixel phones there are. And so I thought it was a good mm-hmm. week to remind everyone what tech is available to you to protect yourself in case of emergency, no matter what the emergency is, right? So, I mean, what Google did was basically make its personal safety app, which used to only be available on Pixel 4s, now available to all Pixels. So Pixel 3, 2, and 1. And it also added a new safety check feature where you can set up a time for the app to check in on you later. So say, you know, you're going out to protest or you're going out to on a solo hike and you might want someone to check in on you, but you don't want to like necessarily ask a friend to call you after. The app can do it for you. And within the app, you can set up things like emergency contacts. So for example, for me, you know, maybe Devendra and I, maybe I'm like, oh gosh, I'm going to this protest. I know Devendra, you know, is my emergency contact, put his name and number in, and then you set the time you want the app to check in on you. And if you don't respond on your phone at that point, the app will send a message that you pre-type to Devendra saying, hey, this person is last known GPS location was this, you know, they haven't responded to our safety check-in, do something. So I think that that's like, it's something that a lot of us have already been doing, just as, I don't know about, you know what I mean? But this is automating it. This is kind of making it slightly easier for you to have on hand. Obviously, the safety app also allows you to enter things like your medical information, just so emergency responders can have it when they need it. And you can allow them to have access to it. So for me, like, I have drug allergies. I really need, like, if I'm unconscious, I need someone to know that they can't inject me with a certain drug.
Right, right.
That's the sort of thing that this provides. I mean, have you ever used something like that, Dev?
Not specifically. I mean, I think I have this set up on my on the iPhone right now. Like, there's an Apple equivalent. There are so many things that people could be doing to stay safe as they're going out to protest right now. Honestly, the best bit of advice I've heard is write a number down on your arm.
Yes.
Because if you end up getting arrested, you will lose your phone. You need to have somebody to call. So there are many kit guides all over the place.
I mean, if you happen to have devices on which you can already enable like one-click SOS outreach, I think that's also important in the case if you fall. And again, not to make this sound like a joke, but if you've fallen and you can't get up. There is this, like, on a lot of wearable smartwatches these days, especially the Apple Watch, actually, you can do a one-press SOS call. I think Wear OS devices also have this. So definitely look it up on your device, how to enable them. You want to enable them when you're safe, so that when you're in trouble, then you don't have to think about it. You just do it to save yourself. I'd rather we all, like, at least have this backup plan rather than go into a situation blind and be like, oh, crap, well, how do I send a message to my friends now? Definitely write down a phone number of someone you trust or someone who knows how to reach people for you on your body, on your person. One thing I'd done before in the past where, like, I've lost my phone is I, like, had to log into an app on my friend's phone. Just be like, oh, get to Twitter. That's how I can reach my friends or something. It's not as easy as like having a phone number down somewhere that you can call, definitely. You've probably also seen lists circulating on Twitter, Instagram, on like a checklist of things to do before you go out to protest. And these typically include things like disable face ID, disable touch ID. And the reason you need to do this is because just in case you're, you know, in a situation where you're being told you have to unlock your phone, the person coercing you into this can't just put your finger on the sensor or just hold your phone up to your face
There have been examples of cops doing this. So you want just your passcode.
Yeah. And something that they can't force you to say. So you just want to be, just protect your data. In that case, you're protecting your data and you're protecting access to your devices, which is basically your life, right? So
let me ask you this, Sherlyn. In a case like this, do you think would you be better off with an iPhone than an Android device?
Wow.
I gotta ask.
I think I've been impressed by the what I've seen, which is like, it looks like there's a sort of macro people have been using to enable a very quick series of actions to be taken on iPhones. I think it's just IFTTT. It looks like it seems to be pretty iPhone specific. So that's the only case where I think that maybe iPhones have that advantage.
Well, also Apple being very privacy conscious and doing a lot of work locally. I'd be interested to see. We don't know this, but we do know that Android phones specifically are, you know, sending a lot of data out to Google. That is how traffic, you know, signaling works. All the stuff is detected for Google Maps. I don't know what cops could be doing with that, but it doesn't make me it makes me a little more worried that there's this platform out there like Android, which is also historically a little more insecure than iOS. Honestly, the ideal thing is do not take a device with you or take a dumb phone. Take a burner.
If you have a dumb phone, if you have an old phone that you've left at home for a long time, take that one and put your SIM card in it to activate service or something. But I think on the front end, on the device side, Android and iPhones are fairly similar in terms of how they unlock. I don't know about face unlock, because there's not a lot of Android phones that really use that level of unlocking yet. But a
there
lot
were
of
some, it didn't go so well. But
yeah, let's not talk about the Samsungs or the ones. They're not the same level. But I will say the back end is a little different, and the back end is where I'm not as familiar. So like whether or not Google's giving like law enforcement access to this information.
This sounds like something that needs to be dug into.
Definitely. Definitely. We're gonna either look into it, or if someone listens and wants to look into it, hey, do it.
All right. So, Sherlyn, what are you working on this week?
Man, so I'm working on a lot as usual. And usually at this time, I think we're all planning like our CES plans, which is like...
partially CES plans. Let me just say, I got the Instagram flashback from 4 years ago.
Oh, no.
4 years ago, you were in Taipei, eating a giant mango, you know, eating the giant mango shaved ice thing, which I love. This is our privilege as reporters who get to travel around the world.
This time of year, we're typically like gorging ourselves in Taipei because we're there to cover Computex, that like trade show that happens in Taiwan every year. And it's like the easiest way for me to kind of get access to all my home food, like food from home.
without actually going
home to Singapore. without having to be surrounded by the people I don't want to be surrounded by, maybe. What I've been doing this week is like subconsciously, I didn't even realize it, but subconsciously I've just been like looking up like a lot of Asian food recipes, and like I've been staring at pictures of mooncakes.
Yeah, your body remembers. Like
my body.
This
like
is when I get my recharge.
Memory.
Yeah.
But speaking of Computex, this week we also saw the CTA announce that it's planning to go on ahead with CES 2021 as an in-person event.
The CTA is the organization behind CES.
The Consumer
you don't
Tech
usually hear
Association.
About yeah.
They're the ones that organize CES every year, and they've announced that, CES 2021 in person. Hell yeah. Hell
yeah. Good luck with that. Good luck with that, buddy. Oh, man.
You know, it just looking at pictures from CES 2020 now, the pictures of the show floor, of the crowds, I get the heebie-jeebies.
That was probably the last major event with a ton of people all in one place before the pandemic.
Well, the
really
Samsung
hit.
Event, I think, was also another one in San Francisco.
But not as big. That's not as big.
Not as big at all. Yeah, definitely not nearly as big. So, man. And also, we've already seen the news that, like, the people with COVID were there.
So I have to ask you, Sherlyn, what will it take for you to go back to CES?
PPE for myself?
Just PPE and not a vaccine? Not like more, you know,
I mean,
immunity?
A vaccine that works, yes. Even then, I would want to be protected because everyone gets sick at CES every year. What are you talking about?
Everyone gets sick, but now it's like literally the pandemic we have to worry about. And I don't know. Also, was it IFA, which happens in Berlin at this point,
is still
inviting
going on.
People. Seems like it's still going on in person.
What they're doing is they're making it an invite-only event to keep it small. So like maybe 200 plus people only.
Don't invite me, please.
For the physical. I mean, I don't want to travel internationally yet. It's too soon.
Too soon,
And for them, it seems like they're inviting people who are more like in the regions. I guess.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. It still feels like it's a little premature. And like, why? Why do you feel like your show must go on? I guess because your people must make money. But
it's a lot of things. I'm also noticing like even in my neighborhood, which is, by the way, the hardest hit community in New York City, which is the hardest hit city in the world, when it comes to the pandemic, people are out there without masks and without protection. So, yeah, I think a lot of people are just ready to move on and pandemic be damned. I'm just, it makes me very, very sad. So, anyway, beyond CES, what's going on, Sherlyn?
So, actual work that I've been doing, I know I've been teasing this for weeks, but that embargoed review of mine went up last week for the Galaxy Tab S6 Lite.
That's all? That's all you were
Stop
teasing?
Stop it. Yes, I was just saying that I can't talk about, but the thing is, a lot of people love our like Samsung Android tablet coverage because very few companies actually make very good Android tablets anymore, and people still want those things.
They're the only company making good Android tablets.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. But mainly, I have a Galaxy Tab S2 still sitting around from a couple years ago.
It lasts forever.
I keep it around. It lasts forever, and also, it has a beautiful OLED screen. And that's something Samsung was doing from the beginning with 100%. the tab system. That alone makes it 100%. Great, even though Android sucks as a tablet operating system, right?
It's not the best OS. Like, so, I'm sorry, I need to laugh about this.
You need to laugh about it. I mean, I've argued about Windows as a bad tablet platform, but at least Windows, like, built in some shit for tablets. Android did not.
Let me tell you why Android is a shitty OS for tablets.
Oh, okay, wow. The tables have turned.
I was happy about it until, like, I opened Instagram and tried to, like, and I was holding the phone, the tablet in landscape mode, okay? I was holding the device in landscape mode. I opened Instagram while in landscape mode. It opens up in landscape mode.
Is it like a tiny square in your screen?
No, no, it takes a full screen, but it opens up, and then it flips to portrait and then stays there, refusing to flip back to landscape, even though I keep rotating the device back and forth. And it's like the OS can't handle the landscape orientation, because when I first opened it, it was landscape. Yeah. And it flips.
To be fair, Instagram just sucks on tablets. Like, there is no iPad support. Yeah. To run it on an iPad, you're basically running the iPhone app. It's ridiculous. But, you know, Facebook is a small company and they have really limited resources and they can only do so much, Sherlyn. Yeah, looking at the Instagram tablet problems, by the way, I just want to throw a shout out to Sarah Friar's book on Instagram, No Filter, because she dives into the conflict between Zuckerberg and the Instagram founders, and like the reason why Instagram has been so like starved for resources and so many things is because Zuckerberg was basically jealous. So that's something. And that really goes into everything we've been talking about Zuckerberg recently.
Back to the Galaxy Tab S6 Lite really quick. You mentioned the OLED screen is the best thing about their tablets. Sadly, this thing uses a TFT display, but it still looks nice. I know. What? I was kind of bummed. I was like,
you had one job.
Yeah. Your only thing is good displays that are AMOLED displays. And, well, I will say the TFT display still look nice.
Is it QLED at least?
No.
Oh,
no.
Come on.
No. So that's sad. Battery life is really long on the thing, but like, yeah, it needs better. I think that the display could be brighter for one thing, and colors are good. Like, angles are fine. The blacks are not as deep for sure. Like, it's a TFT screen.
Oh,
so.
Man.
I know, but it is a lot cheaper. It comes with an S Pen included, so I still like that. And it's very, really fast, so you'll enjoy that. But yeah. And then the other thing that I reviewed this week for an embargo was a Timex smartwatch, but you wouldn't know it was a Timex if you didn't look at the watch logo, because it was completely running Amazfit technology. So I don't know if you guys have heard of the brand Amazfit, but they make these really, really cheap smartwatches that you see all over Amazon. And I was very confused, because at some point in setting up the watch, you have to like grant permissions to the app, to Timex. And everywhere there was Huami, which is a company that owns Amazfit. There was Huami branding. Even the app's API was like Huami.com. And I was like, all right, who am I granting access to?
That should be clearer if you're buying a Timex device and you're granting permission. Were there instructions in the box? Were there any things that said, hey?
No, so that's the thing. I was honestly kind of pissed off, because the whole time there was no wording or indication that Timex had timed up with Huami to make this device. But everywhere I saw the logo. And then when I asked the company, they refused to reply before the embargo. They kept delaying. Wow. They were like, oh, we're still working on an answer for you. And then after the article published, where I pointed out how bad it was that they didn't say a thing, they replied a really lengthy email going, oh yeah, sorry we didn't get you the thing sooner. We're committed to this and that. I'm like, and then they were like, can we send you another unit?
And
that's
you know why, by the way, I can see precisely why this company did this. It was because I think being even partnered with a Chinese company right now is not a good look. They're scared and they're hiding it. Like, wow, tech companies, don't hide things, because we will find out. It's our job and it makes you look worse.
It's like, no, look, a lot of big companies do this, all right? A lot of big companies partner with white label manufacturers to do things. It's fine. The problem here is that you're hiding it. And also, Amazfit itself is a big enough brand. Like, I know of the brand. And it's confusing to your users. So you're not being very responsible by, like, hiding this information. And Timex, like, I expected better, I guess, for some reason. Right. So... So yeah, I mean, I think they have heard what I've said and they seem to be like more open about it now. And I hope that they'll improve in what they actually sell to people come June 10th when the device goes on sale. But yeah, anyhow, Dev, what are you working on?
I mean, I'm still reviewing the ZenBook Duo that I talked about last week. It's fine. It's a very nice dual screen computer. It is maybe a little heavier than I expected, but it's not as big as the ZenBook Pro Duo I reviewed last year, so maybe
What's the battery life like?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's fine, but I haven't done my full battery life test. It's fine. Working on that. Working on some back-to-school guides for us. I know we all are doing that, I'm specifically thinking about gaming laptops and things I could recommend to students, so that's basically been my week. A lot of interviews, a lot of different things happening right now. We don't have any picks in mind this week because there is so much happening, and I think the thing we should all be doing is take a look, like go bear witness to everything happening right now with these protests, with the vast amount of change that's being asked for worldwide. Participate, engage, please take
listen,
a look at everything
read
happening right now. Yes,
take time to yourself and process too. I would say that. And that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at...
At Devendra on Twitter, which I'm still sticking around on, so you can always find me there. And I podcast about movies and TV at the /filmcast at /film.com. Again, we just reviewed Tom Popo. So if you want like a bit of goodness and kindness and fun and joy in your heart as a slight escape from everything else that's happening, please check out that movie.
If you want other sort of goodness, I'm at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter and I try to post nice things on my feed, so check it out. Email us your thoughts and feedback at podcast@engadget.com, and for even faster access to us, you can contact us through the Google form on the page that this podcast is on. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe to us on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.